So welcome to Coffee with the College, a podcast brought to you by the American College of Healthcare Executives, Wisconsin chapter. Why coffee, you ask? Well, our goal is that listeners find this podcast as relaxing as coffee with friends and just as comfortable as you hear guests and observers banter about questions that are on all of our minds. Now, if you've listened to our podcast before, you're familiar with our format. I'm your host, Janet Schultz. I'm Chief Information Officer at a human services company called MyPath. Our observers are Brian Mahulski, Health System Specialist at Zablocki VA Medical Center in Milwaukee, and Abraham Dulhoff, Manager of Virtual Care and Patient Access to Care at Mercy Health. Today, we'll be exploring just a couple of the many public policy issues facing healthcare. Our guests are Ryan Natsky. He's the Chief External Affairs Officer at the Marshfield Clinic Health System, and Brad Walters, Director of Federal Government Relations for the Marshfield Clinic Health System. Welcome, Ryan and Brad.
Thanks for having us.
We're thrilled you said yes to our invitation for coffee.
We're happy to be here.
So to start with, we'd like to get your insider's perspective on current public policymaking landscape at the state and federal level. And if before you get into that, if you want to talk a little bit about your roles, we'd love to hear that too.
Sure, I can kick it off. This is Ryan, and I've been working with Marshfield for about 10 years. I started off as a state lobbyist, and now I oversee our lobbying efforts and our communications department. It's been a fun 10 years. Lobbying is an interesting job. There's a lot of relationships that go into it, but I think in our case, something that we've always prided ourselves on is having depth on the policy issues though as well, and being, you know, wonkish in how we approach these things. And then we use the relationships in order to pursue those goals, which are ultimately to help our patients, to help our communities that we serve, to help our organization and the mission of Marshfield Clinic Health System. I'll pass over to Brad to talk about his role.
Sure. Thanks, Ryan. Like Ryan said, my name is Brad Walters. I'm the Director of Federal Government Affairs for Marshfield Clinic Health System. So I'm the person in D.C. based working with our entire congressional delegation, and really, I think a lot of our partners across organized medicine. It's not just talking to congressional offices every day. It's talking to other hospital systems, other clinical groups, other insurance organizations, and just like-minded stakeholders throughout the city and, you know, this policy landscape every day. I've been with the system for 2 years now. It's a great organization that really cares and really realizes what happens in D.C. has a pretty immediate and impact, a pretty immediate and, you know, important impact on the way we deliver care to our patients.
And I think kind of dovetailing off of what Brad said, I think it's important to note that one of the first things that we do on any issue is you typically go to coalition building. I'd say that's why associations are extraordinarily important within healthcare and within the work that we do. I mean, there are some issues that you work on individually for your organization, but largely we're working on issues that we all are concerned about with other healthcare systems. And so we're reaching out to others. We're doing joint meetings. We're strategizing together on the best way to get these policies enacted and how to communicate with all the decision makers, whether they be at the legislative level or at the agency level. And that's what our days are. Our days are talking to legislators. That's kind of like, you know, what everybody thinks it is. But when you break it down, the amount of time that you're actually talking to legislators, I mean, that's a smaller portion of it. The bulk of that is dealing with staff as well and how important they are. You know, people talk about how DC and Washington are run by, you know, 20-year-olds is, you know, kind of the old adage that nobody realizes. But a lot of the time is spent talking to other lobbyists. It's in the healthcare world. It's talking to internal folks to make sure that we're working on the right issues. And there's a lot more that goes into it than just talking to legislators.
Can I ask a question? You mentioned coalition building. I had a in grad school, I had a teacher. He talked about in his role, he was a lawyer by trade. So he talked about how the most powerful coalitions were the unconventional ones, were the ones that we have a lot of infrastructure around in medicine. We have a lot of infrastructure around, you know, operations and all that kind of thing. But it's not until you take an unconventional look at those groups that they, that he found some really interesting momentum. Can you talk about that? Have you seen some unconventional coalitions that come together that the outcomes are just surprising?
Sure. I mean, if I'll start here, Ryan, and you can fill in if that works for you. But yeah, I think that's the name of the game. It's first and foremost, it's identifying the problem you're trying to solve and really understand it. And that's what Ryan was saying earlier is we want to have a policy approach to this, not just, oh, here's a problem and solve it, but what's the cause of the problem? What are some of the solutions and what are the impacts on patients, providers, communities, things like that? And I think that's sort of a really fun, it can be very fun and very frustrating depending upon the day or the hours, that entrepreneurial spirit of, okay, who else cares about this and sees it this way or can be educated the right way. And that's, I think, a really big part of this role is having enough capacity in our understanding the capacity of our system and sort of the viewpoint there, as well as, you know, who else might care about it. And so it might not just be the health system next door, but I could be talking to somebody in New Hampshire or California that sees it the same way from us. And I might bring some IT perspective and a rural perspective because we cover the top 2/3 of the state and they might be in downtown Los Angeles, but we still have this problem that we can both fix coming from sort of different perspectives and build off each other in a unique way.
Well, and Abraham, to your point, I think that oftentimes in politics now, often we talk about tribes a lot of times, and there's always been tribes and it's always been tribal, but I think we've really seen this, you know, in Wisconsin, we probably saw it after Act 10 in 2011, where it got even more so like that. Although it's always been very partisan, and I think we've seen it more so at the federal level as well. But I think in a similar way, when politics just become predictable of, well, we know the hospitals are going to be here, we know the doctors are going to be here, we know the insurance company is going to be here. When you do kind of flip that dynamic on its head a little bit and all of a sudden like, oh, these guys are on the same team and they're normally not on the same team, then that is a very successful coalition because it does, it breaks the mold of what, yeah, of what legislators are used to seeing.
Yeah, that's great.
So I know we want to get into some specific topics today, but as you were talking, Brad and Ryan, I can't help but wonder how much of your time is spent describing the unintended consequences of what's being considered. Sometimes people have a purpose and a positive intention for a policy, but it's the unique role of a lobbyist could be the unintended consequences of pulling a certain lever. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd say that's comes up in most every conversation on any issue. And we don't pretend to be the experts either as lobbyists. I mean, we're vessels of information from the people that are experts to legislators and decision makers that can be an inch deep and a mile wide. And so we try and bridge that gap of communication between the two parties as much as we can. So that's something that happens regularly because, you know, they think they have a good idea on the face of it. It does look like a good idea, but then you have to explain, okay, there might be a different way to approach this because X is going to happen when you push the button Y. So that happens very regularly.
This is Brian. I'm listening to you talk about an entrepreneurial spirit and everything like that. And you guys are talking to so many of the different entities and different subjects. Have you ever had like a NASA moment where you're researching something and then by the way of gathering information, you find a different issue that's more important, like, and create Tang basically, or like through all your knowledge of going around and talking to all these different people and having all these different perspectives, have you ever had like an aha moment of like, holy cow, that's not what we're tackling, but that will be my next topic?
Yeah, I think we see issues pop up before they pop up quite often. And I think it happens on workforce regularly. I mean, broadband, I mean, some of these are ones that we already know were issues, but then you all of a sudden start realizing like, oh, this is going to impact this and this and this. I mean, the pandemic, that was happening every day where, you know, we're getting our internal reports of what we're seeing. And then we're realizing what the impact of this is going to be on that. March through June, every single day was learning about a new impact that this was going to have. And this is all before this is reaching policymakers, before this is reaching the media. Oh, we were just looking at this, but now we have to make sure that we're ahead of this. That's going to be, because in 3 weeks, this is going to be the big issue that we're going to be worrying about. I think that happens quite often.
For a real concrete example, last year we were running at a very fast pace to get as much telehealth as possible for all of our patients. Then it sort of snowballed into, okay, how do we make sure that our providers have enough connectivity as well as our patients? And so that the broadband came in. Then all of a sudden is, okay, here's the reimbursement rules for a little while, but what's going to happen down the road? And what about all those folks who live in our service area that don't have good video quality, where we all of a sudden have to do phone only, you know, sort of consults? And how do we sort of create a new class of visits for some of our providers while also dealing with the pandemic?
I would say on one of the largest macro issues that's like that is that you can be talking about any healthcare issue. And, you know, oftentimes it comes back to funding and it comes back to reimbursement mix and these different issues. And ultimately creating jobs, good jobs where people have commercial health insurance, especially in rural America and in rural Wisconsin, creating commercially insured patients through job creation is one of the best things you can do for healthcare and for the healthcare system in general, in the state and in the nation, it's not the first thing that you would think of, but as you get down to it, if our communities are more successful economically, that makes it a lot easier for us. Whereas if they're not, that puts a bigger burden on us in order for how to care for these patients.
And that's not a traditional thing a healthcare lobbyist thinks about, but that's what we really take a lot of time to think about is how that reverberates out.
So you mentioned, Ryan, before the term workforce, and it's an issue that has waxed and waned in different ways throughout the pandemic, but it hasn't gone away, and it's going to come back with a vengeance. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of conversations you're having within your health system on the topic of workforce and how that intersects with public policy?
Sure. It's one of, if not the biggest issue, I think that's facing us in the near term that has over the last year, as we've all paid extremely high salaries to bring in nurses from all across the nation to work during some of the crises that we faced. I think this is into the coming future, the short term and the long term, this is probably the biggest challenge we're going to have, and especially for anywhere, but I think especially for rural America. And just, we find that when physicians go to medical school, which are all located in large towns, they typically don't leave to go back to live in rural towns. And the thing is that this is so multifaceted, you can keep pulling back the onion. And I mean, because this is not just about physicians, this is about nurses and allied professionals and nursing assistants and it's the whole gamut. And the thing is that the challenge for each one of these different groups is unique as well. If you're what we find for CNAs or MAs, they might not be able to afford to get the training that they need to go to get the training. When it comes to nursing and nursing schools, they can't pay the faculty. There's no faculty because faculty aren't paid enough. So they have no faculty. With physicians, it's about residencies, oftentimes more so than even the medical school necessarily. So these are all multi-layered And I think that we're going to have to look at a number of policy prescriptions in order to try and get at this.
So in your experience, what do you think are the biggest policy blockers right now? Or if you had Aladdin's lamp and you could rub it and have three wishes, what would your workforce wishes be?
Brad, do you want to take this one?
Sure. I mean, first and foremost, we think if people can train in rural communities, they're much more likely to stay in rural communities. And so that's increased GME slots. That's happening to a certain extent. There was a bit of an expansion in the COVID package that passed in December. We just really want those focused on places that haven't always gotten residency slots before. I also think it's seeing the new technology, seeing the innovation in care delivery through telehealth and other opportunities there for sure. And when you talk about some of the other positions, you know, there are great opportunities for partnership with a lot of different stakeholders to build, you know, almost ladder systems. So if you can start as a nurse's assistant and build up to then, you know, through your work schedule and your life schedule, you know, your personal schedule, over time be supported in your professional growth to sort of move up the ranks and, you know, cultivate our own pipeline of talent over time. I think those are really important. And I think it's also making sure that we can continue, as Ryan was saying, supporting sort of robust communities that we serve as much as possible, to serve as a magnet, you know, compared to a urban center where if a nurse leaves, you know, you go recruit from a pool. But when you're in a small town, if a nurse leaves, there may not be a pool locally to find that next nurse or PA or NP to fill a position. And to understand that, I think, is really important.
And that's why I think with all these different layers, you can't just do one thing. I mean, it's got to be a multi way of approaching this. Brad and I just met with our physician that leads our education department last week. And the line that he said was, medical school creates medical students, creates residencies, and then residencies create physicians. And so, you know, we have to have all those different pieces in place. We have to support all of them. And it's going to take, there's going to have to be funding. It's going to be challenging to see how the healthcare providers themselves are going to be able to fund all of this. There's going to have to be a concerted effort, public-private partnerships, government funding programs to address the workforce needs. And I mean, we haven't even addressed the issue of, you know, there's talk that 25% of the workforce, once we get through this pandemic, is talking about just leaving. I mean, they're burned out. And we haven't figured out how to solve burnout yet. I mean, I know there's a lot of smart people that are thinking about and working on it, but that's a real issue. You know, we had a lot of people coming back to the workforce in order to help out. They're either going to retire or recently retired. And they're going to, there's a good chance they're going to leave pretty soon. And we have an aging workforce. And for us, we've got an aging population in northern Wisconsin. So that creates a real challenging dynamic.
So from a policy perspective, I feel like I'm pretty well tuned in to the virtual care, telemedicine policy and all that that's coming down the line. But from the other perspectives that you've brought up, is there anything in the works on the state or federal level that is kind of a silver lining to the stuff that we're talking about?
I think on the federal side, you know, things like investments in community college and some of the training programs are really important. I think, you know, investment in broadband in general is important, because then there can be more distance learning, e-learning, training types to get there. Like I said, there's that expansion of GMEs. It's 1,000 slots over 3 years that are the CMS funded GME slots. We're still waiting to hear what those are, how those are going to be divvied up exactly. And as well as a bump in the CMS reimbursement rate for teaching slots. I think those are all important first steps, but I don't think those aren't panaceas by any means. And really, I would say if someone said, what describe the federal legislative sort of landscape, I think the next year is all about shifting from a crisis mode to a, what's the end of the public health emergency look like? What toothpaste is out of the bottle that we aren't going to be able to put back in? And what are the lessons learned we're going to take from the pandemic to make more permanent in the care delivery system? And also, what are the issues that have been identified and how do we address those?
Yeah, and in the state, Governor Evers is going to have over $3 billion that over these coming months and years to be put into a variety of different ways. I mean, helping small business, again, so helping the economy. If there are different options in there that can address any of these issues, I think that's still, there are things like that that are on the table. The investment in broadband is happening. I mean, I think Governor Evers had declared it the year of broadband, and they've already got $200 million. And I think there's probably going to be much more that's going into broadband. I mean, that's very exciting for us, given the rural nature of the patients that we see, because it's just a matter of fact that virtual care, video care is challenging for a lot of people. And so for us, the ability to only do audio only and getting reimbursed for it was a big deal, because a lot of people can't do video. And even people in cities oftentimes have challenging times with video. So in the rural areas, that's even more so. So some of those big investments that will be coming, again, that might not be directly into healthcare, but ancillary could definitely have an impact.
Let's pause for a moment to thank our sponsors who make this podcast possible, and for that, we truly appreciate them. Our premier sponsors are Epstein Ewan Architects, HGA, and Hush Blackwell. Our preferred sponsors are Hall Render, Findorf, Nutanix, and Quarles and Brady. I want to go on to one other thing that you mentioned in terms of as we emerge from the pandemic, that the feds mm-hmm. are going to be moving from crisis mode to lessons learned. Mm-hmm. What kind of opportunity does that present healthcare policy makers or lobbyists to have our voices heard?
I think this is a great opportunity for people to tell stories. This is a chance where, frankly, all the attention has come to healthcare, and people have understood the importance of healthcare and public health and prevention, and things like social determinants of health have become much more common in the vernacular. And this is now the time to explain what's happening in a healthcare facility to lawmakers and legislators, and to hear those real stories. I think we have, frankly, the most welcoming audience we've had in a long time. But we have to be able to say, this is my story, and here's how it impacts everybody, or it's more than just me telling that story. I think that's really crucial.
And I think there's opportunity as well, given that this is the first time since the ACA has been passed that you have a Democratic control in the White House along with Congress, and you have a Democrat that is the governor in the state. And so any of the political kind of jostling that needed to occur over these past 10 years is really out of the way as far as it goes with administrative and agency kind of changes that they can make. And so there's definitely some opportunity that can come out of those things in order for how we serve our patients. The one thing that I thought about out of this as well, and that I want to caution about, is that one, we definitely showed our worth over this last year. The people that we work with are heroes, and it's been, amazing to watch the work that's happened. So that kind of put a pause for a year on the talk about how expensive healthcare is. But that's not a conversation that's going away. And I think that in kind of the lineup of who do policymakers look at, I think the insurance companies have always kind of been the big bad guy. I mean, they've always been out there, and we have an insurance company. They're a good one, but that's always kind of in the pecking order. They've kind of always been looked at like that. And then I think the prescription drug companies have been there now, and they're kind of taking their turn. And I think that providers, I don't think that we should think that we're immune from this, that we're never going to be looked at as, hey, you're not just providing healthcare, you're a major cost center, and we need to figure out how to address that. And you're a big part of that. And we do need to figure out better ways to deliver a more affordable service for the patients that we serve.
So when you say that, Ryan, I can't help but keep thinking that our news cycles have gotten so short now, right? The pain of the last years, as awful as it was, sadly could fade very quickly from memory. I'm taking from what you're saying today as a call to action to us and those of listening to this podcast in terms of get the stories out there now while the ears are open. And if, you know, one of the biggest things we could do to impact the cost of healthcare is related to those social determinants of health, right? And nipping things in the bud sooner. And what did we learn about people that are at risk because of lack of access to healthcare? So those are all the thoughts that are going through my mind as I'm listening to you, is let's not let this open ear crisis period go to waste.
And these are the times, these are the moments that we should be using to build those relationships with our legislators. And that doesn't mean just your lobbyists. That means you. If you're listening to this podcast, figure out how to be in touch with your legislator and have coffee with them. Or, I mean, those are the ways that long-term we can build a good dialogue to solve the policy problems of the future. If you just run in there once we're already at crisis mode, or the proposal is on the table that's going to impact you negatively, you might be too late. So right now is when to be talking to people so that you're always at the table when those conversations are occurring.
Yeah, I do have to say, I have written more letters in the past year to my elected officials than I have in my entire life, just because of the passion I felt around this. And so I do think that is a really important takeaway.
Yeah, we had one of the most memorable things that we did through this was when we were really in the middle of it in November, we invited a number of legislators and staff to join. They could just listen in. They couldn't participate, but just to listen in on an incident command call. And I mean, this is a time where we're talking about, well, hey, can we get an update on the mortuary? Because the mortuary is full in town. And some of the different things that we were having to discuss at that time were things that none of us ever would have thought that we were going to have to be discussing. And I think that was really eye-opening for a lot of legislators to see these are the people that are dealing with it on the front lines. And these are the kinds of conversations that they're having to have. I think that was really valuable.
And no, I couldn't agree more with that, Ryan. And also to build on it is your comment about building the relationships now by telling stories. And that's one of our most important roles, is to be a constant presence, not an obnoxious presence, but a constant presence with our legislators and their staffers, so they know that who we are. And so when push comes to shove, we're not trying to build a relationship, but we've already have an ongoing line of communication, and they understand what stories we've told them already, and that those narratives. And so we're explaining, you know, phone only telehealth, because they know how much we care about getting into smaller communities that don't have reliable tele. They are curious by nature, and their role is to learn more about whatever the biggest issue of the day is, or what the biggest issue of tomorrow is.
Yeah. And that idea of stories, I think, is an important one. We all work with people that, you know, talk about peer reviewed studies and health affairs, and that's great. And I'd love to say that that's what ultimately drives public policy, but it's not. A good story, a good anecdote is oftentimes much more powerful on a multiplied level than a really good peer-reviewed study. That's just the reality of what drives people, because, you know, politics can be much more about emotion than necessarily just hard facts. And so that doesn't mean to just dismiss it. It means, you know, to some level you have to embrace that and understand that. And that's why whenever you get the chance, like having the coffee, giving people tours, you know, legislators love tours, get them in your facilities to know what it is you do and where you work.
So one thought that I had as you were talking, Brad, action, the time for action arrives, the time for preparation is over. And if you're in the middle of a crisis and you absolutely need a resource and you haven't done the legwork before, you're out of luck. Right. So I think it's really important that you brought that up. I'll ask a question, and maybe I'm jumping ahead in our conversation. Ryan, you brought up access. And I think maybe that's a good, maybe this is a good segue to that. In my role, virtual care and patient access to care, a lot of the time people think I'm in the revenue cycle. I don't sit in the revenue cycle. I actually sit independent from that. And my role is actually how I analyze how our patients actually interact with the health system. So I may do a revenue cycle process improvement, or I might be actually working with physicians or nurses or registration staff to actually improve our patient's ability. We already talked about affordability, and I think that accounts for something like 68% of the reason patients either postpone or neglect care across the border. We talked about kind of unconventional coalitions before. What are some of the other maybe unconventional ways that you see that we could attack this access problem, improving our patients' ability to access either rural or suburban or urban or whatever the application may be?
I think one of the big ones, of which I have no solutions for, but I think is a big one, is transportation. For us, where somebody might have to drive, they might have to drive 2 or 3 hours to get to Marshfield if the services that they need are not at their local clinic or their local hospital, or potentially even more than that, depending upon where they are. That's a big deal, especially depending upon their age, depending upon their disability, their pain level. And there's a lot of people that they just don't have access to that transportation. But I also don't think it's as easy as just setting up Uber in rural areas. I mean, it just doesn't work like that. And the issues are just so complex in how to deliver this. And the other thing is that we don't have great, this is an area where we don't have great data either. We know it's an issue, and instinctually we know it's an issue, but we also can't point to exactly how much of an issue it is, which means, and how it's an issue, which means we don't know how to solve it.
Ryan, to go back to your public and private partnership, we in the VA, Walmart has actually opened, they have a clinic on site that they give us basically 4 hours a week, and it's telehealth to our facility down here, I think, or in Green Bay, our main clinic. Now, that's not preventing somebody to drive 2 hours for highly specialty care like you're talking about, but it might be primary care or a couple audiology, things like that. Do you guys see any incentives for the public-private partnerships as it, like that, to do clinics within their thing, within their facilities? Or do you see those private entities reducing their own costs by just doing their own employee programs?
One of the good things, and again, this kind of goes back to that silver lining of the pandemic, if you want to call it that, is that, I mean, our brains have exploded over the last year, realizing that anything is possible. And frankly, how much we were able to get done when we focused on telehealth, all of a sudden programs that we've been working on for 10 years were created in 2 weeks. And it's like, all these doctors we could never get to sign up to the program, they're all doing it now. So when we really need to move, we can move when we're focused very quickly. The problem is that we typically have 30 different top priorities going on at any time. And I think that this opened our eyes up to that idea that anything is possible and we don't have to be kind of pigeonholed into these little lanes. So to your point, yes, I think that it's possible. I mean, is there anything on the table right now that I know of? No. But I think that if good groups got together and said, hey, we've got this idea for an innovative program and it looks like it's a good idea, I think there's a lot of opportunity out there right now where you could create an incentive program for something like that.
And from my perspective, I think you're right, Ryan. There's an appetite for ideas to come in from the field, if you will, to policymakers. I would really say everyone should watch what the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation do over the next 12 months. It's a new team coming in. They're going to shift perspectives a little bit. And I think that local care is a big theme for them. And it's the, you know, getting prime, the individual into primary care as much as possible, especially for managing complex conditions. You know, if there's sort of a air traffic control for multiple chronic conditions, people have better outcomes, and they know that. And that's what some of the leadership there really believe.
One of the best things that we ever did as a system to improve our access score was put a telemedicine program in place. We cut almost right off the bat, every metric improved by about 50%.
Well, the thing I would say is that, you know, another thing like that is expanded hours. I mean, we've been in this model of, you know, doctor's offices are open from 8 to 5, Monday to Friday for so long, when, you know what, there's a lot of people out there that are working that they don't work in jobs where they can just leave for an hour. Now, maybe some of that's a little bit different right now, but there's a lot of people that can't. And I don't think that we've ever had a really good recognition of that as a healthcare system in general. And I think that could help move the needle in that space.
I think we're at a pivot point where we need to have a lot more entry points into health systems. It's not just the doctors from 8 to 5. You know, I have a 7-year-old daughter who, she had, you know, a thing on her leg one day, and I was like, do I have to take her out of school, take her to, you know, go back and forth, my day, her day, inconvenience. In the end, we could do a 30-minute video visit, and that saved us all the, you know, the concern, the hassle, and we got it remedied right there. And that's another entry point. And people are going to become accustomed to that pretty soon. And why can't I do that as one of the first steps? The more doors open, I think it's better for the care of the patient in the long run.
Yeah.
I think the thing that we oftentimes don't realize is how much anxiety we can create amongst our patients, that they just want to get some sort of resolution, or they just want somebody to tell them, all right, this isn't anything to worry about right now. And we leave people out there that are really concerned. And that's more damaging to their health oftentimes than even what the actual ailment is that they want to go in and see the provider for. And I think that any ways that we can come up with to reassure these patients, to make sure that they're feeling that they do have the access, is going to help those issues.
So just a couple of comments from my observation. Really, really appreciate the conversation, Ryan and Brad. Don't know whether to take a lot of solace in the fact that everyone all over the country has the same issues or not. But I guess we're all in it together, which ties to the first statement you made, Ryan, and that coalition building is a key factor here. And so we all need to think about that, both from a public policy point of view, but also coalitions or partnerships to solve some of the issues that we've been talking about in the podcast today. And then the other big takeaway I have is conversations, and that we need to be thinking about conversations with our public officials on an ongoing basis, and not make it an extraordinary thing, but just part of our duty in terms of assuring that the voices of our communities and our patients are heard. Good comment, Abraham, about the when it's time to act, it's too late. So I think that's a call to action, actually, for all of us listening to the podcast today. Think about what your topic is and reach out to your legislator on it. Ryan and Brad, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you're open to another conversation, I think in our public policy landscape, the whole topic of ACA or Medicare expansion, it could be its own podcast. I would love to have
a multi-part series.
When I connect the dots to your scary comment, Ryan, about 25% of the workforce looking to exit, and then you couple that with talk about Medicare expansion that then could actually enable and accelerate that exit, we could have even more of a perfect storm brewing than we'd like to think.
We'd be happy to talk about any of it anytime, though.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Thanks to Ryan and Brad for their time and their thoughts.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. You guys understood exactly what we were going for to a T. I appreciate the conversational talk. And Ryan, that's fascinating that you brought the legislators in on your incident command. I wish we would have thought about that. That's a great idea. I mean, 2-a-days for 5-6 months. I mean, we were talking about not sleeping for 5 months. I mean, waking up and going to bed, thinking about incident command, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, that was wild.
Thank you both. And
yeah, I mean, I just remember those times. I mean, the conversations were just so dire. And just, you know, one thing that, you know, like we debated, should we talk about it or not, was I think, I mean, we were getting to the point where we're going to have to determine risk score, right, for triaging. I mean, that's right. Nothing that anybody wants to talk about publicly, but we're literally having to essentially talk about how to ration care at our patients because we are not going to have the ability to take care of them all. I mean, that's a really scary idea. And then you start going into, well, is this going to steer down the conversation of, you know, government making or healthcare making a decision on who lives and who dies? I mean, it goes down this really dark path. And luckily we never got to that point, but we started to have those conversations. And that was, you know, for them to see that, I think, you know, again, it's eye opening.
So the dots do need to be connected. And thanks for sharing that story, Ryan. Yeah. And again, thank you both for having coffee with us. We hope you're open to coffee again sometime down the road. We certainly won't lack for topics. Hope you have a great day.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.